Welcome to Conversations with David Lewis. Today, the man who pushed America to war. My guest is investigative reporter Aram Rostin, talking about Rostin's book, The Man Who Pushed America to War. It's a look at Ahmed Shalabi, the extraordinary Iraqi figure who provided what turned out to be false intelligence to the CIA, the Pentagon, and other state agencies. Intelligence that was key to America's decision to go to war in Iraq. Aram Rostin, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, David.
Who the hell is Ahmed Shalabi, and why should your readers care?
He's an amazing man. He's the man who most people believe we would not be at war in Iraq if it were not for him. So he's an Iraqi exile who had immense influence over a lot of very important people in Washington. And through his efforts, America came to see Saddam as a very, very, very threat. He was born in Iraq from a very, very wealthy family. Then he became an exile at a very young age, at the age of 13. And brilliant man, he became a math professor. And then he became a banker. Then there was a huge scandal, a criminal conviction. And then he became an ardent opponent of Saddam Hussein and began to work with the U.S. government, getting lots of money from the U.S. government to push the U.S. to topple Saddam Hussein.
A math professor, he got his degree at MIT, he loved to go listen to jazz, he was this sort of great raconteur from this very wealthy family, and then he was sort of a con man, and he got chased by the Jordanian government. I mean, who was this guy that America was relying on to tell them what was really going on inside Iraq?
A lot of people now know who he was, sort of as the, quote, leader of the Iraqi opposition and the man who gave us all this phony propaganda and phony intelligence that came up shortly before the war. But before that, before he began working with the U.S. government, he was, as you say, a banker. And he was chased. He fled in the dead of night. He fled from Jordan after his bank was taken over amidst allegations of fraud. And it's significant. His background, his financial background, is very significant, I thought. And the reason it's important is because the CIA and then the State Department and then the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, ended up later giving Ahmed Shalabi, this Iraqi, a lot of money for his efforts supposedly against Saddam Hussein. So when America's government gives so much money to one individual, and we're talking about tens of millions of dollars, it's worth looking at that individual's financial background. In other words, I tried to look at his life there were different periods of his life. And that early period, the neoconservatives and other supporters of Ahmed Shalabi believe he's an innocent man who was framed and was basically framed by Saddam Hussein, who tried to take over this man's bank. That's the story he tells, that he was a victim, a rich banker who was a victim of Saddam Hussein. In reality, it was largely a family enterprise. The Shalabi family owned banks in Switzerland, in Beirut. They had this bank in a subsidiary in Washington. They had companies in London, and they had lots of companies in the Cayman Islands. But what the Petrobank, the one that Shalabi himself ran most directly, that was a bank where a lot of money from depositors was being lent to family enterprises.
What are the one or two most interesting facts about his financial skullduggery that you discovered?
Well, one is it had victims. I mean, people lost a lot of money. The second thing, the real thing, though, is that his claim that it was a conspiracy to take over his bank, it made very little sense, because his bank was basically a chain, like a domino chain, as the Shalabi banks fell apart. It started, the Swiss took over one of the Shalabi's banks. Then the Jordanians moved against Shalabi's bank. Then the Swiss moved against another Shalabi bank. And then the Lebanese moved against the Shalabi bank in Lebanon. So it was this massive worldwide collapse that was engulfed in fraud. And one of the weirder things I learned about him is he was doing business with some very, very peculiar businessmen. For example, one person, Ahmed Shalabi, who became so influential in Washington, one person he dealt with early on was a businessman named Wayne Drizin, who more recently was convicted of wire fraud here in this country. Wayne Drizin went into business with the Shalabi family. In 1980, he tried to buy the Mustang Ranch brothel in Nevada. He was a lawyer who was a disbarred lawyer, disbarred for allegedly ripping off his clients. Then he ends up doing business with the Shalabi family, and the Shalabis were pouring huge amounts of the depositors' money in it.
And this is the guy who we, the American people, end up giving how much money to and taking the word of and leading us to war? How much money?
I think the sum I tabulated was $59 million at a minimum, directly to Ahmad Chalabi's groups that the U.S. government gave. We're talking about over the years, from 92 through 2003, the U.S. government funded Chalabi's Iraqi National Congress. And the issue is, there's a big issue. What did the Americans buy for that money?
Well, they bought a lot of fantasy and fake stories. Give some examples of the most outrageous pieces of, quote, intelligence or fake defectors or that Chalabi produced.
What I found was Chalabi's operations in terms of propaganda and phony intelligence really came to the fore. They really started working after 9/11 when America seemed receptive to these stories. And there were four main storylines that he produced. And again, they were all funded by U.S. taxpayers, these propaganda. And what he did is he carefully fed them to various journalists with prominent news outlets. Those news outlets, it had a resonance, those stories. And the stories were four of them. One of the biggest ones was shortly after 9/11, shortly after hijackers from Al-Qaeda sent by bin Laden killed thousands of Americans at the Pentagon and World Trade Center. Shortly after that, Chalabi's people have put forward the story that Saddam was training hijackers to take over planes. Now, the implication is clear, right, that maybe Saddam trained these hijackers, or that he did. And so these quote sources start coming forward. They're produced and they're given to key journalists. They claim that they saw hijackers being trained in an abandoned plane, at a training camp by the intelligence service in Iraq. So a very powerful story, of course. And it implies there's a direct link between these things. It creates this immediacy that there is an imminent threat if Saddam's training hijackers. It was false. It wasn't the case. And the people who were giving these stories turned out not to be the people they claimed to be. And that was a story that ran on Frontline. It appeared in the New York Times. It appeared in the op-ed pages in various newspapers. And it was spread by Chalabi's people. And it was bogus. There was a training camp. There are always elements of truth in the stories. But as we know, the best propaganda, the best lies, is basically sort of built on an arm of truth, and yet there's nothing there. Another key case that was interesting was a story that ran on ABC News in September of 2002. And that's right before the war, in the months before the war, as American troops are even landing in Kuwait. And ABC News ran the story. It was called Saddam's Mistress. And it was a woman who told a remarkable story. She said she was Saddam's mistress, and she told about his cruelty. Now, we all know he was a cruel, sadistic dictator who, God knows, killed a lot of people. But what she did is she went farther. In this exclusive interview on ABC News, she said she'd seen Saddam Hussein meet with Osama bin Laden. This woman, his mistress supposedly, had seen Saddam Hussein meet with the head of the terror organization, a jihadi organization.
Yeah, they met at the local Starbucks in Baghdad. Yeah.
Exactly. And he's going to bring his mistress along. And yet this aired on ABC News. And the American intelligence believes it to be false. And what's interesting now is I interviewed the journalist who was mainly sort of running it and did that story, the producer, Chris Vlasto. Great guy, great journalist. And he says he now doesn't believe the story. But he did believe it then, but he doesn't believe it now. He said he did his best to check it out. He says he believes the woman was coached or made it up. And she was, again, presented to the ABC News, handed to ABC News by Ahmad Chalabi's group. It's a part of this propaganda effort to move America towards war.
One of the things that you do in the book is you do detail, and I'm sure you haven't made a whole lot of friends, how journalists were played like a fiddle by Chalabi.
He was brilliant at it. I was impressed by this one journalist I talked to named David Rose, who was one of the worst offenders, an English guy, great writer for The Vanity Fair and The Observer. He did a whole bunch of stories that all came from Ahmad Chalabi. And they were all false, by the way. He reported about WMD and nuclear weapons and biological labs that Saddam had, and it all came from Chalabi. He just was convinced by Chalabi back then. After 9/11, again, in 2001, he first met him. And I kind of admire the guy because he's faced up reality, and he says he came and he talked to me at length. He admitted he was wrong, and he said he had an incredible crisis of conscience. He almost wanted to drop out of journalism for how wrong he'd been. And what an impact his false stories had had, and how he'd basically been taken by Chalabi. He tried to investigate himself. It's almost a sort of tragic journalistic story that you'd
absolutely
hate. One could almost see how it could happen to oneself.
Oh, absolutely. Now, you know, there are some journalists who talk to you, like Rose. There are certainly people like Judith Miller who at least appear not to have talked to you.
She did not want to talk, and there's no indication that she has There's no indication that she has distanced herself from Ahmad Chalabi.
That was my question. Are there people who still stand by their stories?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you look at, it's not just them. I mean, the components, I thought, that if, and I spell this out in the book, I try not to do too much speculating or philosophizing. I try to just tell a story. That's what I wanted to do in the book. But I do think there's three ways he really affected America. One was these journalists and this bogus intelligence that he was providing, all, again, funded by the U.S. taxpayer, ironically. Two, this other one was, though, was politically. He had this immense effect, you know, on Capitol Hill because he met a lot of politicians and he had a lot of supporters, and they even passed legislation to help him in 1998, which is remarkable. Three, he had immense what I call strategic impact. He made it plain to these so-called neoconservatives and even to others that somehow they became convinced that toppling Saddam was the way to initiate a process of peace and democracy and stabilization in the Middle East.